Welcome to Alaska Edition, a weekly public affairs program produced by Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated in the studios of KAKM. The host and moderator for Alaska Edition is Michael Carey.
Thank you for joining us. Our guests are Paul Jenkins of the Anchorage Daily Planet, Scott Christensen of the Anchorage Press, and by Skype from Washington, Peter Granitz of Alaska Public Radio. Today in Newtown, Connecticut, today being Friday, a gunman broke into an elementary school and killed 20 children, and seven adults also died there and at one other site. This is a tragedy that has rocked the nation. The President of the United States has commented on it. Many public officials are commenting as the investigation goes on. It is the kind of tragedy that causes not only deep pain and mourning, but a lot of reflection of how does something like this happen. And one of the places it affects most, aside from the families that are involved, is Washington, D.C. And we're going to go briefly to Peter Granitz to tell us what he knows and what he's heard there.
Michael, the details are changing. People don't know specifics. It's very in flux right now. The Capitol is empty today. The House and Senate are out, but people have been very active on social media. You have a number of people coming out right away and saying this is why we need to bring up gun control again, or this is exactly why we don't need to do it. There's been some folks who have gone as far to say we need to arm teachers and train them. It's a very politicized mood right now. We saw the president earlier today come out and give some really somber words saying we've seen this too many times. The only thing we can do is go home and hug our kids harder tonight and tell them we love them. But we don't know much. It's a fluid situation, and the gun control debate is certainly coming back.
Okay. Let's move on to our next topic, and that is Paul Jenkins. We have yet more bad news for the Port of Anchorage and on the Port of Anchorage. The advisory panel of city engineers backs a tough new study. What did we learn? What is ahead for the troubled Port of Anchorage?
See, we've spent $300 million on this thing already in an expansion. At one point, the cost was estimated to be $1 billion. There were problems putting in sheet piling, to be a 1.8 mile front on the dock that would be driven into the mud. Some of those bent, apparently, as they were being emplaced. The Maritime Administration, which had responsibility for overseeing the project, there was federal dollars involved, said, hey, we want to take a look at this thing. So they commissioned a study. It was like $2.2 million study of what happened and what could happen. The study revealed that, yes, indeed, there were problems in design. It pointed to design and said that the design was inappropriate for an earthquake zone, and that the dock would be susceptible to earthquakes. The Geotechnical Advisory Committee had been, the city's engineers had been asking for years for somebody to take a look at this thing. They examined the findings and came back with their own question, which include who specifically approved the design and why this design. And there's several other questions as well that need to be answered. There's another study underway by CH2M Hill that will offer up alternatives for what we can do with what we have at this point.
Well, isn't the one thing that we know for sure is the fix is going to be very expensive?
It's going to be very expensive, and you may not get your Rice Krispies. Who knows?
Okay, I may not get them soon. Scott, you have some interesting local government news for us. There's talk here in Anchorage of redistricting the assembly, moving the local elections from the back to the fall from the spring, making the school board single-member districts, and vote by mail, which is a new one to me.
Vote by mail may be the one thing that comes out of this relatively easily. For one thing, the assembly chairman wants the road service areas to vote by mail, and he believes they can do that without changing the charter. On the big picture front, the charter changes, they're coming at us from two different directions. One, the assembly is going to discuss putting two charter amendments before the voters in April. One would create geographic districts for the school board members. The other would make all assembly districts single member districts. Whether or not they put them on, I don't know. There's also some people petitioning to put similar things on, so there'll be people gathering signatures. And these things may, you know, the people gathering
signatures. Can you really develop any muster for, hey, I'm here, I got this petition, I want you to file for single member districts for road service areas?
Yeah, no, no, but the road service area thing is a much better thing. But the single member districts idea for the assembly just might fly. I don't think the school board's gonna, I don't think voters have turned down geographic districts for school board before. Anchorage has chosen not to do that.
What is the theory behind moving the election date from spring back to fall?
There's an idea that fall is the season for politics and people will show up and more people will vote. I don't know that that's April or October makes much difference. I think that for a lot of people, local government does a halfway decent job. They're not really vested in it.
And what would be the basis of the vote by mail argument?
The vote by mail argument for local road service areas is pretty simple. They want to make things easier on the clerks on election day, prevent some of the problems they had last April. Last April, the
clerks... This would be vote by mail for everything though, right?
Yeah, the petitioners would like to have vote by mail for everything, and they believe that this increases turnout. They claim it increased turnout in Oregon when they went to vote by mail.
And, of course, this would eliminate your local polling place where you're used to going, and presumably it would eliminate also some of the problems we had last election.
Yeah, well, this particular petition would not eliminate the polling places.
Oh,
you would have a choice. You could show up on election day if that's your habit. And I think some people might because they want to hear the ads that happen and when the mud starts flying in the last 7 days.
Yeah, and... Of course, I thought that if you were going to argue for the vote by mail exclusively, you would also be able to argue, you know, we're going to save money because we're not going to have these polling places. But
yeah,
that wouldn't be true.
No, I think the current petition would leave the polling places intact.
Okay, so this gives voters
it's
a choice. That's the argument, voter choice. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Let's go back to Peter in Washington. The fiscal cliff has become a metaphor gone viral. You can't turn on media in any form without encountering references to the fiscal cliff and all the threatening adjectives that go with us. What's happening? How clued in are the Alaska is the Alaska delegation, and is there a compromise ahead that allow everybody to go home for Christmas?
Michael, I commend you for going this far into the show with just now bringing up fiscal cliff. It's the only show in the country this week doing that. Where are we? We don't know. What we do know is that everybody's in the gray. If the news reports talk about phone calls between the president and Speaker of the House, we know something's not going well. If we're just covering phone calls and face-to-face meetings, it means we don't fully have a grasp of specifics. We do know those are the two players. In terms of the Alaska delegation, I've talked to all of them about this. Representative Don Young says he doesn't know. He's put this on the president. He says the president's in command of this. All signs indicate that the speaker is as well. So he's not in the loop. Senator Mark Begich he's a low-level leader in the Senate, but he's in the Democratic leadership. He says that he speaks with Senator Harry Reid quite a bit, daily even, so he gets updates on this. But to be fair, Senator Harry Reid is also not a negotiator on this. It seems to be between the speaker, the president, I can't stress that enough. And Senator Murkowski has said, She's not clued in. She was frank about this when I asked her about it. She said, you know, she speaks to other members of the Senate on a daily basis, whatever that amounts to, I'm not sure. But she's not getting daily briefings, and I don't think she's in the minority in the Senate on that. I don't think anybody really knows what's going on. You see that the House is out of Washington more than it's in right now, and I think that's strategic. I think that the Speaker doesn't really want his members there. I think he wants them out of Washington. That gets them in front of their constituents to keep the message alive. But it also gives him a little wiggle room. It gives him the chance to negotiate with the president without being under the scrutiny of his own members.
Peter, I was going to ask you, there has been a little difference of opinion here recently. Now you're starting to hear some analysts, and especially business analysts from Wall Street and think tanks, saying, well, you know, the fiscal cliff has been, we're sort of scaring ourselves out of our trousers here, that it's not going to, if we go into January for a while, it'll be a little difficult, but we really shouldn't worry unless we start getting into February or perhaps beyond that. Is that getting any traction with the Congress?
Some with the Congress, I don't know many people want to say that publicly. And there are a number who will say that outside of elected office, who will say that, that say, you know, maybe this is a good way. You know, if it comes to debt reduction, sure, this is the way to do it. Raise the taxes, raise the revenues, cut the spending. That's how you get to the end goal. Now, obviously, that could lead to recession. It could lead to higher unemployment rates. It's not a tactful way to do it. People say that, you know, it might be a good way to spur a little action, to go over. Could it be a cliff? Sure. Could it be an off-ramp? Sure. Could it be a bump, a dune, whatever you want to call it? The number's so high because it's a 10-year projection. We put budgets out 10 years in advance. So when you hear about $1 trillion in cuts, you figure that's $100 billion a year over 10 years. And the thing that to recognize is that this first year would be especially hard because we're already a quarter of the way into the fiscal year. The fiscal year begins in October 1st in Washington. So it would be especially hard. But in terms of members of Congress saying, let's do it, there are a number of, a couple handfuls of House Republicans who say, no way, we're not going to budget taxes. If this is what it takes, that's what it takes. I heard Senator Pat Toomey from Pennsylvania this week. He indicated that he doesn't want to budget on taxes. There are a growing number of Republicans in the Senate, Lisa Murkowski has indicated this as well, that they are open to raising rates. It's hard to pin them down on a number, but that might be because they want to give a little wiggle room too, but they also don't want to get on the record too soon and box themselves in.
Peter, with the fiscal cliff preoccupying Washington, what's not happening in the lame duck Congress?
Lots is not happening. We have several things that are pertinent to Alaska. There are appropriations bills. You know, you could label me a Republican in the House or the Republican in the Senate when I say there has not been a budget for 3 years. There's a continuing resolution to keep the government afloat until March. Now that came before this recent impasse, but it's a long ongoing thing. The Violence Against Women Act, you know, they're Majority Leader Eric Cantor of the House put out a message today saying that he's meeting with Vice President Biden about working out some tribal issues about tribal jurisdiction that would largely affect the lower 48 and not Alaska, but it's a sticking point. There's also sticking points on violence against women, the Violence Against Women Act over rights for protections for lesbians, gays, bisexuals, transgenders, transgender people, I should say. Violence Against Women Act, appropriations bills, the Farm Bill, you know, the Farm Bill was something that people thought, you know, it was an indication that the Senate might be getting its stuff together over the summer. They passed amendments. They took amendments up from the minority. They voted on them. There was, you know, just a collegial atmosphere. And they thought, you know what, with the drought, maybe this would go to the House and they could pass it right away. They could reconcile this. But the House leadership didn't want to bring it up before the election. And now we're looking at, 2 weeks left in the Congress and there's no Farm Bill. I mean, this has a lot of implications for the lower 48. There's issues in Alaska that are less obvious. But there's other things. You know, just Monday, we might finally get a disaster relief bill starting to move. It's been 7 weeks since Hurricane Sandy. It took 2 weeks. Now, I don't even think it took 2 weeks after Hurricane Katrina to get a relief bill. And we don't have one yet. For Sandy, it's got to go through the House and the Senate, and it doesn't look like it's going to move fast. And there's also a defense spending bill that could come Monday. They did pass the defense authorization, a policy bill that says what you can and can't do, but they haven't moved along the money on that. So there's a lot of outstanding things.
And for those who don't follow this in the Congress in detail, what is the last day of this Congress or the last weekend, and when does it expire, and when do we get the new group sworn in or the next Congress sworn in?
It depends upon who you ask. Majority Leader Cantor has indicated that he's not going to recess the House of the 112th Congress, which we're in right now, until there's a deal, presumably a deal that's passed out of both chambers of Congress. He says that could be right up until the end of the year. The new Congress gets sworn in January 3rd. The president gets sworn in January 20th. And in between there's always a nice vacation for lawmakers. They don't stick around Washington generally. I think it'll be different this time around. But there's indications that they will be meeting on Christmas. There's a
Have yourself a merry little Christmas. There we go with that. Okay, Peter, we're going to have to go here to Paul Jenkins. Paul, Representative Bob Lynn introduces again an Alaska voter ID law. What does Lynn hope to achieve? What are his prospects?
He hopes to have photo ID required when we go to vote in polling places. He introduced legislation in 2011 It went nowhere, didn't even get a hearing. It was his legislation and his committee, and it never got a hearing. So as we go into this legislative session, this pretty much requires a voter ID to everybody if you want to vote. It's got to be free if you don't have it, you want it, because of the voting constitutional amendment, poll tax amendment. We've got, politically, he's got a Republican legislature. The reapportionment finally put the legislature back in GOP hands. I think realistically, with ACEs out there and the state's fiscal condition out there, tax reform out there, I don't know how much traction it'll get. Just out in public, the Anchorage Daily News has editorialized against it. Letters to the editor seem to be opposed to it. I don't know how far it'll go. I don't know if it'll get any traction. But I understand what he's saying. He's saying that voter fraud is a real possibility. Pew.
I think that wouldn't it have to be that the Speaker of the House, or probably the Speaker, but somebody certainly of
somebody have to get interested.
Important in influence would have to say this is really important.
This is important.
And what you were alluding to earlier with this, with the oil tax legislation. This is stirring up a hornet's nest for some people.
Well, this is. I think what it will do, there'll be a couple of splashes in the pond. The ripples will flatten out, and we'll move on with ACEs and tax reform, because that is the public wants that done. I think, and I think they're making their opinion very clear to
these
guys.
Well, at least it's the assumption of the legislature that that's what's going to be the primary thing.
That's got to be it.
I also wondered, frankly, this is copycat legislation. That's no insult to Bob Lynn. I mean, it's taken from other states or similar to what's in other states.
Right.
Are we apt to see something like right-to-work legislation up here at some point, copying on the states like Michigan and Wisconsin and others?
You look at Michigan and Wisconsin, you wonder, don't you? I don't know. It's been tried before. They've talked about it before. Didn't go anywhere. I got real doubts it'd go very far now, even with a Republican legislature.
And this would raise also the question again of how much of your capital do you want to spend on this particular
issue? That's right. We have severe and real economic problems to look at this time. I mean, if this isn't fixed, with oil throughput and the Trans-Alaska Pipeline dropping at 6% a year, the Department of Revenue is saying, well, for the next year we're going to be $700 million light. Or lighter than we normally are. I don't know how much time.
And I think we can note that in Michigan, the advocates of the right to work law were saying that jobs are going to Indiana because of right to work. Here, if we say jobs are going on North Dakota or someplace,
it's
the argument's over tax policy, not over wages. Scott, Billy the Billboard is a man who has received remarkable attention in the Anchorage press and online. Who is Billy the Billboard for the few who are not knowed up?
Yeah. Well, at the press, we've known him for about 10 years. I think one of my colleagues, Brendan Joel Kelly, who used to write with us, met Billy when Billy was getting tattoos, commercial tattoos on his body. And Billy Gibby is a boxer. He's about 32 years old. The important thing to know is that he was living with bipolar disorder, and he was either undiagnosed or unmanaged or both.
Can we back up just a second if I could interrupt you? Could you explain these commercial tattoos? What is it?
Oh, yeah.
Midas mufflers on your biceps or something?
For the last 10 or 12 years, people have been selling skin. Usually, they're a temporary tattoo on an athlete's body, and in boxing, this has worked because they go to play their game with their shirts off, right? So you can put a big billboard on the person's back. And a few individuals, if you comb the internet in tattoo circles, you'll find a few people putting corporate names on their foreheads for money. Usually these corporations are internet-based companies, the kind that would change the name of a town or an individual to get their name repeated by the media. So in fact, Billy's surname is legally.com right now because he's sold his name. Billy Gibby was undiagnosed bipolar, and when we covered his story in the past, we would see him when he was on what they call an up day, when he was fine, not when he was depressed or, not when he was manic and had, he didn't seem like he had strange expectations. He was simply a boxer who was selling some commercial space on his arms and back.
Like some others.
Yeah. Yeah. He was following the trailblazed by others. However, he, because of his bipolar disorder, he found it hard to hold down jobs. Sometimes he would be depressed and simply not show up to work. He would get in a panic mode sometimes. He didn't know how to pay the rent. He and his wife raised 5 children.
Wow.
So he kept combing the internet, and the tattoos are now going up his face all the way to his forehead. And it's a cluttered mess. Most of the buyers are pornographers. When you get into the face tattoos, he's got some gambling casinos and a local club, you know, on his arms and back. There's a lot of different stuff. He has the logo of a tax company. A person agreed to do his taxes for life because he was having trouble with the W-9s mm-hmm. and whatnot.
So there's and somewhere in here he was diagnosed as having some severe problems.
Yeah, yeah. He kept looking at his face in the mirror, realizing that things are going wrong. And maybe that suspicion that he was different than other people and needed some help. And that's why I really did his story this time, because he kept coming back and calling and asking me to do the story, because there are, he believes there's people just like him who don't know they...
Or there are people that are bipolar that maybe they don't have tattoos, but they might benefit from...
Yeah, he's a rare bird. He's a rare bird in another instance, too, because many, many people with mental illness turn to drugs or alcohol and self-medicate when they're undiagnosed. Here, Billy was undiagnosed, and what he did was exercise and become a boxer, you know? He was addicted to exercise and Coca-Cola, that's what he tells me.
Okay, and are things looking up for him before we say goodbye to him for a minute?
Yeah, one of the mental health agencies actually mm-hmm. employs him in a part-time job, and there's a fund set up to help him remove his face tattoos. He says he does not regret the tattoos on his arms and back.
If we've gone that far, we need to ask, how easy is that to do, since most of us don't know, remove tattoos?
I don't know. He is looking at least a dozen sessions running into like 4 figures each. I think it's like between a grand, I think it's about a grand a session, but I'm not sure. And okay. I haven't done that recently.
Let's leave it right there and go back to Peter Granitz. Peter, Senator Olympia Snowe of Maine is leaving the United States Senate and gave a farewell address to her colleagues and to members of the public, presumably, and certainly to reporters. You were there. What did Senator Snowe have to say, and what application might it have for the future?
Well, this is that one time every 2 years that political reporters like being political reporters a lot. The Senate being the Senate, any member can take to the floor and talk about whatever they want for however long they want. And this is the time when members go down and give their toasts, so to speak, their farewell address of themselves, or get honored by another person. And there was 2 this week that were of note, and Olympia Snowe is probably the key one. I was in the chamber watching it, and she was talking about her years in the Senate, her years as a bipartisan compromiser. She had worked with Ted Kennedy on health insurance issues, and she had worked all over the issues. You know, she worked on immigration. She was a Republican who voted to acquit Bill Clinton in the impeachment trials. Notice what was interesting was about who was in the chamber. You know, when you watch C-SPAN, you only see the speaker. You don't realize that the chamber's empty. They can't pan the cameras by law. That's how it happens. So I was standing above and looking down in the room where Senator Mary Landrieu, moderate from Louisiana, Democrat, and Senator Lisa Murkowski was in there. She was sitting in the corner, not at her own desk, but she was sitting there and clearly looked like she was paying close attention. And when Olympia Snowe finished up, she walked over and congratulated her, and I wish I would have known what she said, but you know, this is one more moderate leaving the Senate, and one who is leaving explicitly because nothing's happening and she's frustrated with it. And it was telling to see the moderates that were in the room. Also, a moderate who gave a farewell speech this week was the stately Indiana Senator Dick Lugar. Long-time expert on foreign relations, an advocate for the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea, which would affect Alaska. But he did take the time in his farewell speech to advocate exports of liquefied natural gas. He didn't specifically mention Alaska. But it's just another moderate that says, you know what, I mean, he lost his primary, he's a different story, and he has issues with how far right the Republican Party's gone. And I think a number of people are worried that losing Olympia Snowe, losing Senator Lugar, and perhaps in the new faces, the Senator Ted Cruz, Senator-elect Ted Cruz's of the world, people are worried that the Senate's going to slow down even more. It's not supposed to be a fast-moving place, but it's supposed to be a deliberative place. It's supposed to be a nuanced place. And the moderates are good at keeping it that way.
Does Senator Snow offer Senator Murkowski something of a model, or is that are they just too different and representing states that are too different?
Maine and Alaska are not the same. You know that probably just as well as anybody. She represents a rare breed, kind of an older breed, the one of the Judd Gregs of the world, the Northeast Republican, who socially liberal, fiscally conservative, moderate to conservative. But it went beyond just social issues on a lot of times, the environment and economic issues too. Her big thing was moving things in the Senate, making sure that they could actually debate things even if you disagreed. But Senator Murkowski is in the position that she needs to be the top Republican on energy and the top Republican on the Energy and Natural Resources Committee. And that's a committee that tends to get along with the other party, but it's also a partisan position because the Democrats have entrenched positions on oil and gas with a handful of exceptions like Senator Mark Begich and an incoming Senator Heidi Heitkamp from North Dakota. And the Republicans have entrenched issues on energy policy. So I don't know that she's going to stake out on her own and kind of be this courted senator like Senator Snow was. You know, she was the one Republican to vote to move along the health care bill in a committee. She didn't vote for passage, but that was her thing. She wanted it to be debated. I don't know that Senator Murkowski is going to be that person. I don't know that she's going to stake it out, in part because of who she is, but also in part because of the Energy Committee and her stance on having to be the top Republican in that sense.
Thank you very much. Scott, the Department of Labor took a look at Girdwood, its economy, its population, things that are associated with those kind of analyses. And you took a look at what the department did, and you took a look at Girdwood. What did you find out about the community?
Well, there's a couple of things that were interesting. It grew really fast in the 90s. We know that the population did. And when I called the economist, I called Neil Fried and asked him about these jobs numbers. You know, he counted up 900 jobs total in Girdwood, 900 jobs in Girdwood. So that's not the same as 900 workers. There's some workers that are commuting from there. In fact, their commute time is, their average commute time is 25 minutes. So the number of people doing the 1 hour, the 2 hour commute to and from town is bringing up the average a lot in Girdwood, because I can imagine there's a lot of people with a 5 minute walk.
That's very good.
You know, yeah. If you've walked around there, you can walk from housing to a cup of coffee or a donut or a ski lift, you know? And that's how it is, in a ski village. It's interesting, it's a company town, you know, about 700 jobs are either at the resort or related to the resort.
And some of the people who have places that are absentee owners.
Yes.
Okay, and we're going to have to be absentee too. We're out of time. Thank you for joining us on Alaska Edition.
If you have questions or comments about the program, you can email Alaska Edition at alaskaedition@alaskapublic.org. Or write us at 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508. Alaska Edition is a production of KAKM. The opinions expressed are those of the host and guests and do not necessarily represent those of KSKA, KAKM, the licensee, or their underwriters.